services are being pushed to the limit, with a paramedic describing them as on the fringe of collapse in a recent BBC report. And the already substantial numbers affected by long COVID are continuing to grow. Professor Tim Cook, a consultant in anesthesia and intensive care medicine, said, "In many settings, COVID is an inconvenience now rather than a threat to life, but it continues to have a significant impact on our healthcare. Essential infection control measures are an ongoing burden for hospitals, and staff absences are piling pressure on the system even further." Professor Tim Cook said, "It's a fairly fragile ecosystem. You still have the issue of patients presenting later. Because primary healthcare is difficult to assess, a degree of staff exhaustion, it remains a system under a lot of stress. From a healthcare perspective, the pandemic is certainly not over. There is not a single simple solution to curbing the steady tide of infection." Vaccines have been an overwhelming triumph of the pandemic, but those in use have major limitations in managing this phase. They provide crucial protection against severe illness and death, but not against infection. And protection against mild illness wanes very quickly. This creates a zone of rapidly diminishing returns when it comes to boosting the young, healthy population. There's clear recognition that what we've got now is not ideal, said Adam Finn, a professor of paediatrics at the University of Bristol and a member of the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, which announced recently that everyone aged 50 years and over would be offered a COVID booster shot in the autumn. Professor Adam Finn added, "We've got a tool that is really good at stopping the old folks from dying. We're more or less given up on the idea of mass immunisation to control the spread of infection. Vaccinating everyone every 3 months is just not feasible." He said special cases could be made for vaccinating healthcare workers, for instance, in anticipation of a tough time in January, adding, "Giving them all a vaccine in November would help." British officials claim the situation could improve as the next generation vaccines become available. Major programs are underway to develop variant-proof vaccines or even pan-coronavirus vaccines that would also work against other endemic coronaviruses. And some predict that these vaccines could produce more enduring community. There are also efforts to develop a nasal vaccine similar to the flu vaccine given to primary school children that would be more likely to protect against infection and transmission as well as the illness itself. Professor Danny Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College London, is among those calling for governments to pursue these solutions with far greater intensity. He said, "In early 2020, we had a real unity of purpose on vaccines, which went terribly well. After that, we downed tools and lost interest, but it's not job done, it's job unfinished. We're still in the heat of an arms race, and we're in a stage now we need to up our game." There are also the well-known lower-tech approaches to pandemic management. Germany is investing in improved ventilation systems in schools and in public buildings. New Zealand announced recently that it would bring back free face masks and COVID tests amid a growing Omicron wave, and other countries continue to have stricter guidance on mask wearing and self-isolation. However, in Britain, there appears to be little enthusiasm for more active management of COVID. the beginning of the end. Part 1.
When Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities were targeted in drone attacks, Riyadh could hardly imagine that the consequences of the face-off with Yemen would be so harsh. Saudi Arabia is Yemen's largest neighbor and the largest country in the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the country is comprised of vast deserts, Saudi Arabia owes its significance among Arab and Islamic countries to two holy and religious cities of Mecca and Medina. Islam is the birthplace of Saudi Arabia and was exported to other countries. After the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia gradually became one of the, or I'd better say, the biggest oil exporter in the world. Saudi Arabia's significance today is a combination of the historical significance and its economic weight. Saudi Arabia has always been pivotal in the developments in Yemen, but the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen has many complications. When supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Arab nationalists rose up against the ruling of the Zaydis, Saudi Arabia sided with the Zaydis because if Nasser had come to power, it would pose a danger to Arab monarchies. Nasser became Egypt's president after toppling a monarchical rule. He was against Arab and even Iranian monarchs. He had strong socialist tendencies, and at the same time, he would call himself an Arab nationalist. He would fight with Israel and the UK on the one hand, and on the other, he used a different name for the Persian Gulf and claimed that the three Iranian islands belonged to Arabs. After the 9/11 attacks, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had previously toppled the Zaydi rule, got closer to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh secretly funded al-Qaeda and got closer to Saleh, so Saleh released many al-Qaeda terrorists in return. But the friendly ties faced a major problem. The problem was initiated somewhere far away. A poor man in Tunisia set himself ablaze in front of a government building. It was the beginning of a revolution that spread to many Arab countries. It was the beginning of a new story for Yemen. The The wave of Islamism in the world was set off in 1979 after the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Before that, anti-West activists in the region were either nationalists or socialists and leftists. But after the revolution, inclinations towards Islamic teachings turned into the major inclination in the anti-Western activism among the people of the region.
In 1986, a political group named the Houthi Union was formed in this part of Yemen.
Scholars like Mohammed Badreddin al-Houthi and Majid Eddin al-Muyaidi taught subjects about Iran's revolution to the group. Yemeni's interest in the revolution stemmed from their passion for Islamic teachings. Traditionally, there were people who had lived with those teachings generation after generation, and they naturally welcomed the teachings in the political and social arena. The Association of Faithful Youth was established in 1992. Badreddin al-Houthi had a role in founding the association along with Muhammad Saleh Azam and Abdul Karim Jaban. In 1997, the organization of the Faithful Youth splintered off the previous association under the leadership of Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi. Hussein's goal was to return to the ruling by the imams and abstention from giving zakat, that's religious taxes, to the illegal government. In other words, they wanted to establish an Islamic government. In fact, the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran served as a role model. In Yemen, just like in Lebanon, Bahrain, Palestine, and Afghanistan, some people came up with the idea of establishing an Islamic government. Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi moved towards military training. After the military training in the Organization of the Faithful Youth was raised, more youth welcomed it warmly. Ali Abdullah Saleh's government had a dual approach vis-a-vis the organization. At first, it tolerated the organization and even financially supported the organization's schools and its cultural activities because by the help of the organization, it could stop Al-Qaeda and Wahhabi infiltration in Yemen. Wahhabis took advantage of the abject poverty in Yemen and propagated themselves to find supporters. Saudi Arabia also funded them. Ali Abdullah Saleh was worried the changes may threaten his own government as well. But when he found out about their political tendencies and military training, things changed. He closed down the organization's schools and put their leaders under surveillance. But Sayyid Hussein Houthi's father, Sayyid Badreddin, who was one of the revered religious marjayas in Yemen, intervened to reopen the schools. The government set a condition that Sayyid Hussein has no right to get involved with the schools. Hussein moved to Sada'a. Sada'a is a city near the Saudi border in a mountainous region. It's an old city with typical Yemeni buildings, but now it's the capital of Sada'a province.
Houthis are from this province. Hussein al-Houthi moved from Sada'a to a small province named Haydan, 39 kilometers away from the provincial capital Sada'a. Hussein al-Houthi became the prayers leader of the Grand Mosque in Haydan and started his activities to recruit forces. In the Zaydi sect, only a person who rises up with a sword can become a leader, just like Zayd, Imam Zayn al-Abidin's son, the Zaydis follow. So Hussein proclaimed his leadership. The main motto of his movement was to fight the U.S. Politically, Hussein was a supporter of the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's more, he supported anti-Israeli Islamic groups like Hezbollah and the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Sayyid Hussein considered Israel as one of the main enemies of Islam. He launched a campaign to ban Israeli and U.S. goods in Yemen. The administration of Ali Abdullah Saleh sensed the danger. An Islamic movement in Yemen, similar to Hezbollah, could be a threat to his long-time rule. Many Houthi youths were arrested on charges of trying to restore the Zaydi government. That was a time when the U.S. faced the 9/11 attacks. أحداث الحادي عشر من أيلول سبتمبر. If Wahhabism was considered a problem for Muslims and the Islamic world, now, after the September 11th attacks, everyone in the world was saying that Wahhabism is a major problem. Asked many countries to arrest certain individuals known as Wahhabi leaders who were tied to terrorist activities. In Yemen, several names were mentioned who were top political figures. Yemeni tribes would not turn them in. Ali Saleh knew Yemen's tribal structure and decided not to get into a conflict with the structure. So he negotiated with the U.S. ambassador in Yemen and convinced him that the Houthi movement was more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. Ali Saleh's main argument was that the Houthi movement followed Imam Khomeini's thoughts, and it means the Houthis consider the U.S. as their main enemy. Finally, on the sidelines of a G8 summit in 2004, Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to get Washington's approval to crack down on the Houthis. The crackdown started in Sada'a. In September of 2004, Hussein al-Houthi was killed in Amaran district, but his death did not put an end to the war.
حين بدأت المواجهات ما بين القوات الحكومية وأتباع الحوثيين ف...
When the war broke out between followers of the Houthis and the government forces, there were only 200 Houthi fighters. But after Hussein al-Houthi's death, his brother Abdulmalik al-Houthi recruited several hundred thousand people for the organization. Abdulmalik was Hussein's younger brother. He was born in 1979. His ideas were not different from his brother's, fighting with oppressive rulers and providing welfare and education for the poor. After Hussein al-Houthi's death and Abdulmalik's succession, Hussein's father, Badreddin al-Houthi, went to Sana'a for talks with Ali Abdullah Saleh, but he returned empty-handed. The war started again. In the spring of 2005, the second war ended after the victory of the government. In the fall of the same year, the conflict started once again and continued until the spring of the following year. In 2006, while there was a truce agreement between the Houthis and the government, the Houthis demanded that 7 Yemeni Jews be expelled. They said the 7 Jews spread corruption among the youth. In reaction to the request, Ali Abdullah Saleh wrote a letter to Abdulmalik and asked him to hand over their arms and forces. Soon, the fourth war broke out, and in the spring of 2007, the fifth war. The fifth war started after several people close to the government were assassinated and the government accused the Houthis of those killings. A claim refused by the Houthis, but the war was inevitable. This time around, the war spilled over to other provinces as well. Ali Abdullah realized that the odds were against him. During the 30th anniversary of his presidency on July 17, 2008, he announced that the fifth war was over and promised that no new war will be launched between the government and the Houthis. But his promise did not last long. The following year, on July 10, 2009, Ali Saleh claimed that the Houthis had violated the truce and attacked government-controlled areas. The Saleh government launched a Saudi-backed airstrike on the Houthis. Saleh talked to the heads of the tribes and warned them that the Houthis want to restore the Zaydi movement under the leadership of Abdulmalik. This time, the Houthis were successful. They had Katyushas and cannons and managed to achieve numerous victories. The U.S. and Saudi fighter jets directly entered the war. But the Houthis took shelter in the mountainous areas that were not accessible by the fighter jets. These mountains have served as a hideout for Yemeni fighters against offensive tribes for centuries. Now, the mountains became the shelters for the Yemenis once again. February 2010, the tribal chiefs intervened to stop the war. Next year, in 2011, Sadaa and the Houthis were no longer the biggest threats to Ali Abdullah Saleh. Ali Saleh was the president of Yemen for decades. He was planning on having his son succeed him. Corruption was widespread across the country and people were poor. It wasn't anything new, but when people got the news that revolutions were taking place in Tunisia and Egypt, Yemenis also took to the streets. This time, Sana'a turned into the resistance bastion against the government.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump appears to be losing support among Republican voters for a 2024 White House bid as the public hearings of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack against the U.S. Capitol have unfolded, according to new opinion polls. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Trump Losing GOP Support for 2024 Run as January 6 Hearings Unfold. Former President Donald Trump appears to be losing support among Republican voters for a 2024 White House bid as the public hearings of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack against the U.S. Capitol have unfolded, according to new opinion polls. Donald Trump has not officially confirmed that he plans to seek another presidential term, but has repeatedly hinted at the idea as a strong possibility. While opinion polls have generally shown the former president as the clear front-runner for the Republican Party's nomination, his viability might be taking a hit as the January 6 hearings feature what many view as damning testimony by his own former administration officials and other Republicans. Polling data by Reuters and Ipsos, released on Thursday, 21st of July, shows that Donald Trump is losing support among GOP voters for a 2024 presidential run. Survey data collected from 20th to 21st of July showed that about one-third or 32% of Republicans strongly or somewhat agreed with the statement that Donald Trump should not run for president again in 2024. That was an increase from about one-quarter or 26% who said the same just 6 weeks ago. Additionally, in the previously early June opinion poll, 51% of Republicans strongly disagreed with the statement that Donald Trump shouldn't seek another term. That level of strong disapproval with the statement dipped 10 percentage points to 41% in the latest opinion survey. Relatedly, the level of Republicans who believe Donald Trump is at least partially responsible for the January 6th insurrection has increased as well. In June, one-third or 33% strongly or somewhat agreed with the statement that the former president is at least partly to blame for starting the Capitol riot. In July, that amount has increased to 40%. Among GOP respondents to the July opinion survey, 9% said Donald Trump was fully responsible for the January 6th insurrection, while 15% said largely and 29% said partially. At the same time, a majority of Republicans still expressed belief in Donald Trump's misinformation, with 55% saying that they strongly or somewhat agree that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. However, that level has gone down 11 percentage points in the past 6 weeks. Other potential Republican 2024 candidates continue to draw buzz from analysts and lawmakers alike. Donald Trump's Vice President Mike Pence has increased appearances at conservative events in recent weeks and has made some high-profile endorsements against his former boss's preferred candidates in key primary races. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appears to be the most popular GOP candidate after Donald Trump, according to multiple opinion polls. I've heard a lot of people that really want to look at some fresh blood. I'm sure we'll have some of the same folks engaging in the opportunity. It's an open opportunity for everyone, Senator Joni Ernst, an Iowa Republican who serves in leadership, told the website Politico for an article published on Friday. She said that, in the end, it's up to our voters to decide. Speculation is mounting that former Vice President Mike Pence plans to run for president in 2024, regardless of former President Donald Trump's ambitions, as GOP lawmakers are reportedly encouraging him to run. Although opinion polls continue to show that Donald Trump is the front-runner for the Republican Party's nomination. Mike Pence endorsed Karen Taylor Robson in Arizona Republican primary gubernatorial race this week, after Donald Trump previously endorsed Kerry Lake. That endorsement from the vice president came after he has already opposed Donald Trump's preferred candidates in several other high-profile primary races ahead of the midterm elections. Furthermore, CNN reported on Thursday, 21st of July, that some GOP lawmakers encouraged Mike Pence to throw his hat in the ring for the party's 2024 nomination, as he spoke to a meeting of the Conservative Republican Study Committee caucus in Congress this week. The former vice president has also been filling his schedule with more events in recent weeks. Some Republican strategists and lawmakers have grown increasingly concerned about Donald Trump's viability in 2024 amid the public hearings of the House Select Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021 that have featured what many view as damning testimony for Donald Trump. Although Donald Trump has not confirmed plans to run in the next presidential election, he has repeatedly hinted that he aims to seek another term in the White House. Recent opinion polls show that Donald Trump is the front-runner for the Republican Party's nomination, but many analysts have floated the possibility of Mike Pence or Florida's GOP Governor Ron DeSantis as strong potential challengers.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
For many years, there have been efforts led by the African Union to silence guns in the continent in an attempt to achieve a conflict-free Africa. Now, the embassy of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Nairobi, Kenya, has supported the African Union's endeavors to flush out illegal firearms by holding a cartoon festival. The Iranian ambassador to Kenya, Dr. Jafar Barmaki, speaks here during the conclusion of the festival in Nairobi.
Through this festival, the embassy, in line with the efforts of African Union, has accelerated the two calls to action by assimilating both 2020 and 2021 themes, which has enabled a promotion of African culture and heritage while fast-tracking on silencing the guns in Africa.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on how the Iranian embassy in Nairobi uniquely contributed to the African Union silencing the guns in Africa agenda by organizing an international cartoon festival. The second segment of our program will be on the ongoing tensions between Rwanda and the mineral-rich Democratic Republic of Congo. We are asking, what is the source of the current tensions in this volatile region? Stay with us till the end of our show.
Cartoons Exhibition, Silencing Guns in Africa. Silencing the Guns in Africa agenda is a flagship initiative of the African Union's Agenda 2063 that aspires to end all wars, conflict, and gender-based violence, and to prevent genocide. Speaking at the closing of the 14th Extraordinary Session of the Assembly of Heads of State and Government of the African Union, AU, on silencing the guns, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said efforts to silence the guns will continue for the next 10 years.
The AU must have roadmap on practical steps to silence the guns clearly outlines the outcomes we seek to achieve as a continent. It is therefore appropriate that we reiterate our commitment to extend the master roadmap for the next 10 years, while we also continue to declare September of each year as Africa Amnesty Month.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a long-standing partner of the African Union, and it is within this framework that the Iranian Embassy in Nairobi last year organized a world cartoon festival on applying arts and culture in silencing the guns in Africa. In collaboration with the Regional Center on Small Arms in the Great Lakes region, the Horn of Africa and bordering states. Now, to discuss more about this festival and its impact, we contacted the Iranian ambassador to Kenya, Dr. Jafar Barmaki. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on an interview.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, what made you join the African Union's initiative of silencing the guns in Africa to achieve a conflict-free Africa to prevent genocide and end wars in the continent?
As you may know, and your audiences, that Africa has a very special place in our foreign policy. And in this regard, we are trying to help Africa to come up with the challenges at the moment. And the silencing the gun, as was presented by African Union some years ago, we try to be help in that regard and to send a message around the world, because if you just have that project in Africa, I'm sure it cannot be worked, because we need to send message to the other countries. It is not only Africa who can work on that issue, but they need the other countries to get on board. This is why I try to send this message through Khartoum to the other part of the world. And as you may know, some countries trying such kind of situation in Africa to plunder the resources of the African continent. Therefore, it is very important to have peace in this continent to prevent plundering resources by the other countries.
The Embassy of Iran in Nairobi marked the 2021 International Day of Peace by awarding artists who participated and won in the World Cartoon Festival on silencing the guns in Africa. Globally, the winner was Cao Gomes from Brazil.
Hello, everyone. It's a great honor for me to receive this award at this festival. It's a very important and special moment that values my ideas and drawings. The choosing theme is very urgent and call for a lot of reflection and political action.
I'd like to ask Ambassador Barmaki to tell us more about the response from local Kenyan and international cartoonists to this cartoon festival.
It was really fantastic because we received lots of cartoons around the world. More than 70 countries, cartoonists from more than 70 countries send their artworks to the secretariat of the festival. Not only from the other countries, but also we had lots of cartoons from African countries, although cartoon is not very much developed as in the other countries in Africa. Therefore, but it was very good. We really amazed by the number of the cartoons we received. It was more than 1,000 cartoons.
Now, the Director of Capacity Building and Institutional Development at the Regional Center on Small Arms spoke during the awarding ceremony of winning cartoonists and lauded the Iranian Embassy in Nairobi for this initiative.
Ending conflicts, addressing proliferation, illicit trade, and trafficking of small arms, which are the weapons of choice and are at the core of all conflicts in Africa, is a huge task that needs concerted effort within and outside the region.
Now, what was the response of the African Union or African governments to this cartoon festival that you organized?
Unfortunately, a kind of political approach they got about this cartoon festival. Although I tried to reach African Union, United Nations in Kenya, as you know, we have two specialized agencies, United Nations Environment Program and United Nations Human Settlement Program in Nairobi. The headquarters are here, so they are the only headquarters in developing countries. Therefore, I try to get them on board and several other organizations. But unfortunately, due to the political approach they taken, we couldn't have them on board. And although the governments, even the Kenyan governments, were not very helpful in that regard. But since I decided to have this cartoon festival, to send a message around the world and to keep silencing the gun projects alive. So I did my best, and I think somehow I was successful.
In December of 2020, the African Union decided to extend the Silencing the Guns initiative until 2030. One of the most effective ways of supporting its plan of action can be through cultural festivals such as the Cartoon Festival, organized by the Iranian Embassy in Nairobi. For the African Union initiative to be successful, a wide spectrum of the society needs to be involved.
Any initiative cannot be only on paper. If you are looking to see that kind of initiative to be successful, you need to get as much as possible people's, organizations, governments to be on board. And in my point of view, it was very good that to send message through cartoons. And I could see when we had the exhibition here, because after the closing of the festival, we hold almost 10 days exhibition in Nairobi. And I could see that many ambassadors who visited the exhibition, they were very excited that how the people around the world think about silencing the guns in Africa.
The language of cartoons is truly universal, and it brings together hearts and minds of people from diverse cultural backgrounds. Now, do you think cartoon festivals like the one you organize can indeed be a medium of bringing cultures together?
As I mentioned, from among the prize winners, you can see that they are from Latin America, and it is far from Africa. But they understand the situation. It shows that they understand each other, and they can bring the culture closer to each other. This is why I'm trying to hold the exhibition of the selected artworks around the world. I had in some month ago, I had in British Columbia, in Canada, the workshop, the exhibition, and nowadays it is held in Brazil, and in Kenya we had. In near future, we are going to have in Iran, and I'm still working with my colleagues around the world to hold this exhibition in other countries, and I'm sure it will help.
Thank you, Ambassador Barmaki, for your time. That was the Iranian ambassador to Kenya speaking on the World Cartoon Festival on applying arts and culture in silencing the guns in Africa. Now, as we mentioned earlier in the program, the global winner of the festival's cartoon competition was a Brazilian. Now, following the good response from Brazilian cartoonists, the Iranian embassy in Brazil organized an exhibition of the World Cartoon Festival on Silencing the Guns in Africa at the University of Brasilia. Now, to get a brief insight on this, we contacted Iran's ambassador to Brazil, Dr. Hussein Gharibi. Thanks, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today.
You're most welcome.
Now, what made you think of holding this Silencing the Guns in Africa cartoon festival in Brazil?
You know, it was a theme of festival that was held in Africa last year with our embassy in Kenya organized this event. And a good number of people participated, artists from all over the world participated in this contest. And the winner was a Brazilian, Carl Gomes, from Belo Horizonte, a city in Brazil, was the first winner. So I decided to invite him to the capital, to Brasilia, in order to present to him his award, and also to have the opportunity to put on display all the artwork that we received for the festival. And the best place was the University of Brasilia in this city. It is the biggest university in the capital, and now all artworks are on display.
A leading Cuban cartoonist, famously known as Aris, took the second position globally in the festival. And again from Cuba, Michel Moro Gomez took the third position. Let's listen to their speech here after learning that they were winners.
Hi. First, I want to express my gratitude to the organizers of this event, the Embassy of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Nairobi, Kenya. This World Cartoon Festival, Silencing the Guns in Africa, is a very important issue because we are talking about peace. I'm so happy to know that I am one of the cartoonists who won an award in this festival, and I have African blood in my veins, and it made me feel even happier. Congratulations to the winners and to the organizers. Bye.
Hello, dear friends. My name is Michelle Moro Gomez from Cuba. It is my pleasure, this invitation, to share a few words with you. I believe that is a great idea to celebrate a festival with the topic Silence the Guns in Africa, because it is a way to show one of the biggest issues that lash this continent. It was a motivation to me to draw about this topic, to fight by the peace through a creative form and from the art. Thank you very much and greetings to everybody.
Now, what is the importance of holding such competitions and how can they act as a catalyst for dialogue and peace among cultures?
I can say that the art is the global language. Through art, people can communicate with each other without interpretation, without usual translation. So this language is very much affected. And I could see, 62 artworks from 15 countries. They had a lot of common elements in them. And the turnout of the university students and other people interested in going and seeing the artworks in the University of Brasilia is really amazing, and it shows how art can affect people, and we can use this language in order to promote peace and peaceful societies.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Gharibi. Now, our next topic is still on issues of conflict, and we shall be discussing the ongoing tensions between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But before we move to our next topic, we shall take a short break. Stay with us.
Rwanda, DRC tensions.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has accused Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels, which Rwanda denies. And this has sparked a diplomatic row between the two neighboring countries. The March 23 movement, famously or infamously known as M23, is a former Tutsi-dominated rebellion that was defeated in 2013 and took up arms again late last year, blaming Kinshasa for not respecting agreements on the demobilization and reintegration of its fighters.
The tensions between Kinshasa and Kigali raised concerns over the possibility of the conflict escalating further in this volatile Great Lakes region. Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, have agreed to a de-escalation process between their two countries following bilateral talks to address rising tensions on their mutual border. The two leaders held the talks in Luanda, Angola's capital, at a tripartite summit hosted by Angolan president who was appointed by the African Union to mediate.
The Congolese president expressed hope that the talks will lead to the withdrawal of the M23 rebels.
I really hope and expect this process to bring about an immediate ceasefire and the withdrawal of this M23 group. while obviously waiting for the process to be set in motion, the roadmap that will lead to a process of peace, stability, and confidence.
To discuss the Rwanda-DRC tensions, we have contacted Claude Gatabuke, the executive director of the Africa Great Lakes Action Network. Now, what is the source of tensions between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo?
The source of the tension between Rwanda and the DRC, the very base and bottom of it is Congo's resource. And Congo is the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. And what we have is $24 trillion worth of resources. And Rwanda is basically a conduit for multinational companies and foreign countries that are looting the Congo. So the M23 rebellion, to keep it simple for the audience, is actually Rwanda's military invading the Congo.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is potentially one of the richest countries on Earth. This country plays a significant role in the world supply of cobalt, copper, diamond, tin, and gold. The country produces over 70% of globally produced cobalt. These mineral riches have made the DRC a target of regional and trans-regional neo-colonial powers seeking to loot and plunder this Central African country. The government of Rwanda has categorically rejected claims that it backs M23 rebels in the eastern DRC.
There is no presence of Rwandan soldiers in DRC, and from there, there could not be any collaboration with any other force present in the eastern DRC if there is no presence of Rwandan soldiers.
Are foreign or trans-regional powers involved in the recurring conflict between these two countries?
Definitely. Foreign trans and trans-regional powers are involved. There is a bunch of mining companies, many of them Canadian, and a bunch of others from various other countries in Europe and around the world, including the U.S., including the U.K., France, Belgium, and others, Australia, that are all involved in the exploitation of Congo and the Congolese people.
Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have agreed to a de-escalation process following one-day talks between their presidents, mediated by Angola. However, renewed clashes between M23 rebels and DRC forces have led to concern that the truce between Kigali and Kinshasa will not last.
The DRC has accepted a proposal for an East African regional force to be deployed in its east to help control the violence, but only if Rwanda does not take part. Now, do you think this force can restore peace in eastern DRC?
We do not need more military in the Congo. We need justice in the Congo in order for the Congo and the region to actually prosper. So the recommendations in the UN mapping exercise report to set up international tribunals to try the perpetrators of the crimes in the Congo is going to bring about lasting peace. I don't think the force is going to bring lasting peace. I do think that justice is going to bring lasting peace, starting with using the UN mapping exercise report of 2010 as a basis for persecuting the perpetrators of those crimes.
Well, there you have it. The conflict in the DRC does not have a military solution, but rather there should be justice for peace to prevail. I would like to thank our guest, Claude Gatabuke, for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.